Nisao ducked into the tent, the light of Sidar around her winking out as she did so. In the brief instant before the tent flap fell shut, Saren, her bald-headed stump of a warder, was visible outside, a hand resting on his sword hilt, and his head swiveling, plainly standing guard. "May I speak with you alone?" the diminutive sister said. Short enough to make Saren seem tall, she always minded Romanda of a large-eyed sparrow. There was nothing tiny about her powers of observation or her intellect, however. She had been a natural choice for the council the Ajahs created to try keeping an eye on Egwene, and it was certainly no fault of hers that said council had had little or no restraining effect on the woman. "Of course, Nisao." Romanda casually closed the book and eased up to tuck it beneath the yellow-tasseled cushion on her chair. It would never do to have word get around that she was reading that. "It must be almost time for your next class, Bodawin. You don't want to be late." "Oh, no, Aes Sedai. Sharina would be very upset." Spreading her white skirts in a deep curtsy, the novice darted from the tent. Romanda compressed her lips. "Sharina would be upset. That woman was emblematic of all that was wrong with allowing those above 18 into the novice ranks. Her potential was beyond incredible, but that was beside the point. Sharina Malloy was a disruption. But how to be rid of her? Her and all the other women too old to have had their names written in the novice book in the first place. Provisions were strictly limited for putting a woman out once her name was in the book. Unfortunately, over the years, a number of women had been found to have lied about their age to gain entrance to the tower. By a few years only in most cases, but allowing them to remain had set precedence. And Egwene Alvear had set another, and much worse. There had to be some way to overcome it. "May I make us private?" Nisao asked. "If you wish. Have you learned something about the negotiations?" Despite Egwene's capture, talks continued under the pavilion at the foot of the bridge in Darain, or rather, the semblance of talks. They were a farce, a dumb show of obstinacy, yet it was necessary to keep a close eye on the negotiators. Varalyn had snatched most of that work to herself, claiming Grey Aja prerogative. But Magla found ways to wriggle into the matter whenever she could, and so did Soroya and Takima and Faisella. Worse than the fact that none of them seemed to trust the others to carry out the negotiations, or much at all, for that matter, at times all of them almost seemed to be negotiating for Elida. Well, perhaps it was not that bad. They held fast against the woman's ridiculous demand that the Blue Aja be dissolved, and argued, if not nearly with sufficient force, for Elida stepping down. But if she and Lilaine, she was forced to admit, did not stiffen their backbones now and then, they might well accede to some of Elida's other odious conditions. Light. At times it was as if they had forgotten the entire purpose of marching on Tar Valon. "Pour us tea," she went on, gesturing to a painted wooden tray sitting atop two stacked chests that held a silver pitcher and several battered pewter cups. "And tell me what you've heard." The glow surrounded Nisao briefly while she warded the tent and tied off the weave. "I know nothing of the negotiations," she said, filling two of the cups. "I want to ask you to speak to Lilaine." Romanda took the proffered cup and used taking a slow swallow to give herself time for thought. At least this tea had not yet turned. Lilaine? What could there be about Lilaine that required warding? Still, anything that gave her leverage against the other woman would be useful. Lilaine seemed entirely too smug of late for her to be entirely comfortable about it. She shifted on the seat cushion. "Regarding what? Why don't you speak to her yourself? We haven't fallen as low as it seems the White Tower has under Elida." "I have spoken to her. Or rather, she has spoken to me. And rather forcefully." Nisao sat down and set her cup on the table while she arranged her yellow-slashed skirts with overly elaborate care. She wore a small frown. It seemed she was fiddling for time, too. "Lilaine demanded that I stop asking questions about Anaya and Chiron," she said finally. "According to her, their murders are Blue Aja business." Romanda snorted, shifting again. The book's wooden cover was a hard lump beneath her, its corners digging into her hip. "That is utter nonsense. But why were you asking questions? I don't recall you being inquisitive about such matters. The other woman touched her cup to her lips, but if she drank, it was the tiniest sip. Lowering the cup, she almost seemed to grow taller. She sat up so straight. A sparrow becoming a hawk. Because the mother ordered me to. Ramonda kept her eyebrows from rising only with an effort. So? In the beginning, she had accepted Egwene for the same reason she suspected every other sitter had. Certainly Lelaine had done so, once she realized she could not attain the stolen staff herself. A malleable young girl would be a puppet in the hands of the hall, and Ramonda had fully intended to be the one pulling her strings. Later it had seemed obvious that Swan was the true puppeteer, and there had been no way to stop her short of rebelling against a second Amarlin, which surely would have shattered the rebellion against Elida. She hoped Lelaine had ground her teeth over that half as much as she had. Now Egwene was in Elida's hands, yet in several meetings she had remained cool and collected, determined in her course of action and that of the sisters outside Tar Valon's walls. Ramonda found in herself a grudging respect for the girl. Very grudging, but she could not deny it. It had to be Egwene herself. The hall kept a tight fist on the dream Tarangrial, and though no one could find the one Lyanna had been loaned before that dire night, she and Swan had been practically at one another's throats. There was no question of Swan slipping into Telairanriod to tell the woman what to say. Was it possible that Nisau had come to the same conclusion about Egwene without seeing her in the unseen world? That council had stuck very close to her. "That is reason enough for you, Nisau?" She could hardly slip the book back out without the other woman noticing. She shifted again, but there was no comfortable position on the thing. She was going to have a bruise if this continued. Nisau twisted her pewter cup about on the tabletop, but she still did not look away. "It is my major reason. In the beginning, I thought she would end up as your pet, or Lelaine's. Later, when it was clear she had evaded both of you, I thought Swan must be holding the leash. But I soon learned I was wrong. Swan has been a teacher, I'm sure, and an advisor, and perhaps even a friend. But I've seen Egwene call her up short. No one has a leash on Egwene Alvear. She is intelligent, observant, quick to learn, and deft. She may become one of the great Amarlins." The bird-like sister gave a sudden brief laugh. "Do you realize? She will be the longest-sitting Amarlin in history. No one will ever live long enough to top her, unless she chooses to step down early." Smiles faded to solemnity, and perhaps worry. Not because she had skirted the edge of violating custom, however. Nisau schooled her face well, but her eyes were tight. "If we manage to unseat Elida, that is." Hearing her own thoughts thrown back at her with emendations was unnerving. A great Amarlin? Well, it would take many years to see whether that came about. But whether or not Egwene managed that considerable and unlikely feat, she would discover that the hall was much less amenable once her war powers expired. Romanda Cassin certainly would be. Respect was one thing, becoming a lapdog quite another. Standing on the pretext of straightening her deep yellow skirts, she drew the book from beneath the cushion as she sat back down and tried to drop it surreptitiously. It hit the carpet with a thud, and Nisau's eyebrows twitched. Ramonda ignored that, pulling the book under the edge of the table with her foot. "We will." She put more confidence than she felt into that. The peculiar negotiations and Egwene's continuing imprisonment gave her pause. Forget the girl's claims that she could undermine Elida from within. Though it seemed half her work had been done by others, if her reporting on the situation in the tower was accurate. But Ramonda believed because she had to believe. She had no intention of living cut off from her Aja, accepting penance until Elida thought her fit to be fully Aes Sedai again. No intention of accepting Elida Arroyhan as Amarlin. Better Lelaine than that. And one argument in her own mind for raising Egwene had been that it kept the stolen staff from Lelaine. No doubt Lelaine had thought the same concerning her. "And I will inform Lelaine in no uncertain terms that you can ask any questions you wish. We must solve those murders. And the murder of any sister is every sister's concern. What have you learned so far? Not a proper question, perhaps, but being a sitter gave you certain privileges. At least, she had always believed it did. Nisao displayed no pique at being questioned, no hesitation in answering. Very little, I fear, she said ruefully, frowning at her wine cup. It seemed there must be some link between Anaya and Chiron, some reason they two were picked out, but all I've learned so far is that they had been close friends for many years. Blues called them and another Blue sister, Cabriana McCandice, the Three, because they were so close. But they were all close-mouthed, too. No one recalls any of them talking about their own affairs, except with each other. In any event, friendship seems a feeble motive for murder. I hope I can find some reason why anyone would want to murder them, especially a man who can channel, but I confess it's a small hope. Romanda furrowed her brow. Cabriana McCandice. She paid little attention to the other Ajahs. Only the yellow had any truly useful function. How could any of their passions compare to healing? Yet that name chimed a small gong in the back of her head. Why? It would come to her, or not. It could not be important. Small hopes can grow surprising fruit, Nisao. That's an old saying in farmadding, and it's true. Continue your investigation. In Egwene's absence, you may report what you learned to me. Nisao blinked, and her jaw tightened briefly, but whether or not reporting to Romanda sat well with her, there was little she could do but obey. She could hardly claim interference in her affairs. Murder could not be one sister's affair. Besides, Magla might have gotten her ridiculous choice for the third yellow sitter, yet Romanda had secured the position of first weaver for herself easily. After all, she had been head of the yellow before she retired, and even Magla had been unwilling to stand against her. The position carried much less power than she would have liked, but at least she could count on obedience in most things, from yellow sisters, if not sitters at least. As Nisao untied her ward against eavesdropping and let it dissipate, Theodrin popped into the tent. She was wearing her shawl spread across her shoulders and down her arms to display the long fringe, as newly raised sisters often did. The willowy Damani had chosen brown after Egwene granted her that shawl, but the brown had not known what to do with her, despite finally accepting her. They had seemed ready to largely ignore her, entirely the wrong thing, so Romanda had taken her in. Theodrin tried to behave as if she really were Aes Sedai, yet she was a bright, level-headed girl for all that. She spread her brown woolen skirts in a curtsy. A small curtsy, but a curtsy. She was well aware that she had no right to the shawl until she had been tested, and passed. It would have been cruel not to make sure she understood. "Lelaine has called the sitting of the hall," she said breathlessly. "I couldn't find out why. I ran to tell you, but I didn't want to intrude while the ward was up." "And rightly not," Romanda said. "Nisao, if you will excuse me, I must see what Lelaine is about." Gathering her yellow-fringed shawl from atop one of the chests holding her clothing, she arranged it over her arms and checked her hair in the cracked mirror before herding the others outside and seeing them on their way. It was not so much that she thought Nisao would have looked for what had made that thud if left in the tent alone, and she was certain Theodrin would not, but it was better to take no chances. Aelmara would replace the book where it belonged, with several similar volumes in the chest that held Romanda's personal possessions. That had a very stout lock with only two keys, one kept in her belt pouch, the other in Aelmara's. The morning was crisp, yet spring had arrived with a rush. The dark clouds massing behind Dragon Mount's shattered peak would deliver rain rather than snow, though not on the camp, it was to be hoped. Many of the tents leaked, and the camp streets were a bog already. Horse carts making deliveries splashed mud from their high wheels as they made new ruts, driven by women for the most part, and a few gray-haired men. Male access to the Aes Sedai camp was strictly limited now. Even so, nearly every sister she saw glided along the uneven wooden walkways wrapped in the light of Saidar, and followed by her warder if she had one. Romanda refused to embrace the source whenever she went outside. Someone had to set an example of proper behavior, with every sister in the camp on tenterhooks. Yet she was very conscious of the lack. Conscious of the lack of a warder, too. Keeping most men out of the camp was all very well, but a murderer was unlikely to pay any heed to the restriction. Down the street, Gareth Bryn rode out of a crossing street, a stocky man with mostly grey hair, his breastplate strapped over a buff-coloured coat and his helmet hanging from his saddle bow. Swan was with him, swaying on a plump shaggy mare and looking such a pretty girl that it was almost possible to forget she had been hard-bitten and sharp-tongued as Amarlin. Easy to forget she was still an accomplished schemer. Blues always were. The mare plodded along, but Swan nearly fell off before Bryn reached out to steady her. At the edge of the blue quarters, the camp was laid out in rough approximation of the Aja quarters in the tower. He dismounted long enough to help her down, then climbed back into his bay's saddle and left her standing there, holding the mare's reins and gazing after him. Now why would she do that? Blacking the man's boots, doing his laundry. That relationship was abhorrent. The blue should put an end to it, and to the pit of doom with custom. However strong, custom should not be abused to hold all Aes Sedai up to ridicule. Turning her back on Swan, she started toward the pavilion that served as their temporary hall of the tower. As pleasant as it was to meet in the true hall, not to mention under Elida's very nose, few sisters could manage to put themselves to sleep at any hour, so the pavilion must continue to serve. She glided along the walkway without haste. She was not about to be seen hurrying to answer Lelaine's call. What could the woman want now? A gong sounded, magnified with the power, so it carried across the camp clearly, another of Sharina's suggestions, and suddenly the walkways were crowded with novices hurrying to their next class or to chores, all clustered by family. Those families of six or seven always attended class together, did chores together, in fact did everything together. It was an effective way to manage so many novices. Nearly 50 more had wandered into the camp in just the last 2 weeks, pushing the total back near 1,000 in spite of runaways, and almost a quarter of those were young enough to be proper novices, more than the tower had held in centuries. Yet she wished it were not Sharina's work. The woman had not even suggested it to the mistress of novices. She had organized the thing herself and presented it to Tiana whole and complete. The novices, some of them graying or with lines in their faces, so that it was difficult to think of them as children despite their white dresses, squeezed to the edge of the walkway to let sisters pass while they offered curtsies, but none stepped into the muddy street to make more room. Sharina, again. Sharina had spread the word that she did not want to see the girls dirtying their nice white woolens unnecessarily. It was enough to make Romanda grind her teeth. The novices who curtsied to her straightened hurriedly and practically ran. Ahead of her, she spotted Sharina herself, talking to Tiana, who was shrouded in the glow of Sidar, doing all of the talking, with Tiana merely nodding now and then. There was nothing disrespectful in Sharina's demeanor, but despite novice white, with her creased face and gray hair and a tight bun on the back of her head, she looked exactly what she was, a grandmother. And Tiana had an unfortunately youthful appearance. Something about her bone structure and large brown eyes overwhelmed the ageless look of Aes Sedai. Lack of disrespect or no, there was too much appearance of a woman instructing her granddaughter to suit Romanda. As she approached them, Sharina offered a proper curtsy. A very proper curtsy, Romanda had to admit, and hurried off the other way to join her own family, waiting for her. Were there fewer lines in her face than there had been? Well, there was no saying what might happen when a woman began with the power at her age. 67, and a novice. "Is she giving you difficulties?" she asked, and Tiana leaped as though an icicle had slid down the back of her dress. The woman lacked the dignity, the gravity necessary in a mistress of novices. At times she seemed smothered by the number of her charges, too, and she was much too lenient besides, accepting excuses where there could be none. She recovered quickly, however, falling in beside Ramonda, though she smoothed her dark gray skirts unnecessarily. Difficulties? Of course not. Sharina is the best-behaved novice in the book. Truth to tell, most are well-behaved. The greatest number sent to my study are mothers upset because their daughters are learning faster than they, or have a higher potential, or aunts with the same complaint of nieces. They seem to believe the matter can be rectified somehow. They can be surprisingly adamant about it until I set them straight about being adamant with any sister. Although a good many have been sent to me more than once, I fear. A handful still seem surprised that they can be switched. Is that so? Ramonda said absently. Her eye had caught pale-haired Delana hurrying in the same direction, gray-fringed shawl looped over her arms, and her so-called secretary striding at her side. Delana wore an almost somber dark gray, but the Saranoff trollop was in blue-slashed-green silk that left half her bosom on display and fit much too snugly over hips that she rolled blatantly. Of late, the pair of them seemed to have abandoned the story that Halima was merely Delana's servant. Indeed, the woman was gesturing emphatically while Delana merely nodded in the meekest manner imaginable. Meek! It was always a mistake to choose a pillow friend who did not wear the shawl, especially if you were fool enough to let her take the lead. "Sharina isn't only well-behaved," Tiana continued blithely. "She is showing a great skill with Nynaeve's new way of healing, like a number of the older novices. Most were village wise women of one sort or another, though I don't see how that can have any bearing. One was a noble in Mirandy." Ramonda tripped over her own heel and staggered 2 paces, arms flailing for balance, before she could catch herself and gather her shawl. Tiana put a hand on her arm to steady her, murmuring about the unevenness of the walkway's planking, but she shook it off. "Sharina had a gift for the new healing? And a number of the older women?" She herself had learned the new way, but while it was different enough from the old that the second learned weave limitation seemed not to apply, she had no great gift for it. Not nearly what she had for the old method. "And why are novices being allowed to practice that, Tiana?" Tiana flushed, as well she should. Such weaves were much too complex for novices, not to mention dangerous if misapplied. Done improperly, healing could kill rather than cure. The woman channeling as well as the patient. "I can hardly stop them from seeing healing done, Ramonda," she said defensively, moving her arms as if adjusting a shawl she was not wearing. "There are always broken bones or some fool who's managed to cut himself badly, not to mention all the illness we've had to deal with lately. Most of the older women only have to see a weave once to have it down." Abruptly, for a bare instant, red returned to her cheeks. Smoothing her face, she drew herself up, and defensiveness fell away from her voice. "In any event, Ramonda, I shouldn't need to remind you that the novices and accepted are mine. As mistress of novices, I decide what they can learn and when. Some of those women could test for accepted today after only months, when it comes to the power, at least. If I choose not to make them twiddle their thumbs idly, it is my decision to make. Perhaps you should run see whether Sharina has any further instructions for you," Ramonda said coldly. Spots of crimson staining her cheeks, Tiana turned on her heel and strode away without another word. Not quite forbidden rudeness, but close. Even from behind she was the image of indignation, her back stiff as an iron rod, her steps quick. Well, Ramonda was willing to admit she had come near rudeness herself, but with cause. Trying to put the mistress of novices out of her mind, she set out toward the pavilion again, but had to restrain herself to keep from walking as fast as Tiana. Sharina, and several of the other older women. Should she rethink her position? No, of course not. Their names should never have been allowed in the novice book in the first place. Yet their names were there, and it seemed they had mastered this wonderful new healing. Oh, it was a tangled snarl. She did not want to think about it. Not now. The pavilion stood at the heart of the camp, a much patched piece of heavy canvas surrounded by a walkway 3 times as wide as any of the others. Holding her skirts well up out of the mud, she hurried across to it. She did not mind haste when it got her out of the mud more quickly. Even so, Aelmara would have a time cleaning her shoes and her petticoats, she thought, as she let her skirts down, decently concealing her ankles once more. Word of the hall sitting always drew sisters hoping for news of the negotiations or of Egwene, and a good 50 or more were already gathered around the pavilion with their warders, or standing just inside, behind where their sitters would sit. Even here, most shone with the light of the power, as if they were in any danger, surrounded by other Aes Sedai. She found herself with a strong urge to walk around the pavilion, boxing ears. That was impossible, of course. Even if custom could be set aside, which she had no desire to do, a chair in the hall gave no authority for such a thing. Shiriam, the narrow blue stole of the keeper vivid on her shoulders, stood out in the crowd, in part because there was a clear space around her. Other sisters were avoiding looking at her, much less approaching her. The flame-haired woman embarrassed many of the sisters, appearing every time the hall was called to sit as she did. The law was quite clear. Any sister could attend a sitting of the hall unless it was closed, yet the Ammerlin could not enter the hall of the tower without being announced by the keeper, and the keeper was not allowed in without the Ammerlin. Shiriam's green eyes were tight, as usual, and she fidgeted in an unbecoming manner, like a novice who knew she was due another visit to the mistress of novices. At least she was not embracing the source, and her warder was nowhere in sight. Before stepping beneath the pavilion, Romanda glanced over her shoulder and sighed. The great bulk of black clouds behind Dragonmount was gone, not drifting apart, simply gone entirely. Very likely there would be another wave of panic among the grooms and laborers and the serving women. Surprisingly, the novices seemed to take these strange occurrences more in stride. Perhaps that was because they were trying to take their cues from the sisters, but she suspected Sharina's hand again. What was she to do about the woman? Inside, 18 cloth-covered boxes, colored for the 6 Ajahs represented in the camp, made platforms for polished benches, 2 slanting rows atop the layered carpets, widening toward a box covered with stripes in all 7 colors. Wisely, Egwene had insisted on including red, despite considerable opposition. Where Elida seemed determined to divide every Aja from every other, Egwene was determined to hold them all together, including the red. The wooden bench atop that platform had the Ammerlin's 7-striped stole laid across it. No one claimed responsibility for placing it there, but no one had removed it either. Romanda was uncertain whether it was meant to be a reminder of Egwene Alvir, the Ammerlin's seat, an echo of her presence, or a reminder that she was absent and a prisoner. How it was seen, doubtless, depended on the sister looking. She was not the only sitter taking her time to answer Lelaine's call. Delana was there, of course, slumped on her bench and rubbing the side of her nose, her watery blue eyes pensive. Once Romanda had considered her level-headed. Unsuitable for a chair, but level-headed. At least she had not allowed Halima to follow her into the hall and continue her harangue. Or rather, at least Halima had chosen not to. No one who had heard the woman shouting at Delana possessed any doubts who gave the orders there. Lelaine herself was already on her bench, just below the Ammerlin's, a slender, hard-eyed woman in blue-slashed silk who rationed her smiles tightly, which made it doubly odd that now and then she glanced toward the 7-colored stole and gave a small smile. That smile made Romanda uneasy, and few things could do that. Moria, in blue wool embroidered with silver, was striding up and down in front of the blue-covered platforms. Was her frown because she knew why Lelaine had called the hall and disapproved, or because she was worried over not knowing? "I saw Mirel walking with Hugh," Malind said, hitching up her green-fringed shawl as Romanda entered the pavilion. "And I don't think I've ever seen a sister looking so harassed." Despite the sympathy in her tone, her eyes sparkled and her full lips quirked with amusement. How did you ever talk her into bonding him? I was there when someone suggested it to her, and I vow she turned pale. The man could almost pass for an ogier. I expressed myself forcefully on duty. Facella, stocky and square-faced, was forceful in everything. In truth, a hammer of a woman. She mocked every tale of seductive Domani. I pointed out the clue had been becoming more and more dangerous to himself and others since Chiron died, and I told her it couldn't be allowed to continue. I made her see that, as the only sister ever to save two other warders in the same circumstances, she was the only choice to try doing it again. I'll admit I had to twist her arm a little, but eventually she saw the right of the matter. How under the light could you twist Mirel's arm? Malin leaned forward eagerly. Romanda passed them by. How could anyone have twisted Mirel's arm? No. No gossip. Janya was on her bench for the brown, squinting in thought. At least she was squinting, but the woman always seemed to be thinking of something else, even when she was talking to you. Maybe her eyes were bad. The rest of the benches still stood empty, though. Romanda wished she had been more leisurely. She would much rather have been the last to arrive than one of the first. After a moment's hesitation, she approached Lilaine. "Would you care to give an idea of why you called the hall?" Lilaine smiled down at her, an amused smile, yet unpleasant even so. "You might as well wait until we have enough sitters to proceed. I don't care to repeat myself. I will tell you this much. It will be dramatic." Her eyes drifted to the striped stole, and Romanda felt a chill. She did not let it show, however, merely taking her bench across from Lilaine. She could not help glancing uneasily at the stole herself. Was this some move to unseat Egwene? It seemed unlikely the other woman could say anything that would convince her to stand for the greater consensus, or many of the other sitters, since that would throw them back to the struggle between her and Lilaine for control and weaken their position against Elida. Yet Lilaine's air of confidence was unnerving. She schooled her features to calmness and waited. There was nothing else to do. Quamesa all but darted into the pavilion, her sharp-nosed face chagrined at not being first to arrive, and joined Delana. Salita appeared, dark and cool-eyed in yellow-slashed-green embroidered with yellow scrollwork on the bosom, and suddenly there was a rush. Lirella glided in, graceful and elegant in brocaded blue silk, to take her place with the blues. Then Soroya and Aledrin with their heads together, the blocky Domani seeming almost slender alongside the stout Tarabonner. As they took their places on the white benches, fox-faced Samalin joined Facella and Malind, and tiny Escaralda scurried in. She scurried! The woman was from Farmadding, too. She should know better how to behave. "Verilyn is in Darain, I believe," Romanda said as Escaralda climbed up beside Janya. "But even if some others arrive later, we have more than 11. Are you content to begin, Lilaine, or do you wish to wait?"
"I am content to begin."
"Do you wish a formal sitting?" Lilaine smiled again. She was being very free with those this morning. They did nothing to warm her face.
"That won't be necessary, Romanda."
She rearranged her skirt slightly. "But I ask that what is said here be sealed to the hall for the time being." A murmur rose from the growing crowd of sisters standing behind the benches and those outside the pavilion. Even some of the sitters showed surprise. If the sitting was not formal, what need could there be to restrict knowledge of what was said so closely? Romanda nodded as though it were the most reasonable request in the world, though.
"Let all depart who do not hold a chair. Aledrin, will you make us private?"
Despite dark yellow hair of a silky texture and large liquid brown eyes, the Tarabonner white fell short of pretty, but she had a good head on her shoulders, which was far more important. Standing, she seemed uncertain whether she should speak the formal words, and finally contented herself with weaving the ward against eavesdropping around the pavilion and holding it. The murmuring faded as sisters and warders passed through that ward, until the last was gone and silence fell. They stood in ranks, shoulder to shoulder on the walkway, watching, however. The warders all crowded to the rear so everyone could see. Adjusting her shawl, Lelaine stood. A green sister was brought to me when she came asking for Egwene. The green sitters stirred, exchanging glances, no doubt wondering why the sister was not brought to them instead. Lelaine affected not to notice. Not for the Ammerlin seat. For Egwene Alvere. She has a proposal that meets some of our needs, though she was reluctant to say very much of it to me. Moria, will you bring her so she can present her proposal to the hall? She resumed her seat. Moria left the pavilion still frowning, and the crowd outside opened up enough to let her through. Romanda could see sisters trying to question her, but she ignored them, disappearing across the street and into the Blue Aja quarters. Romanda had a dozen questions she would have liked to ask in the interval, but informal session or not, questions would have been improper at this point. The sitters did not wait in silence, however. At every Aja except the Blue, women stepped down so they could come together and speak in low voices, except the Blue and the Yellow. Salita climbed down and walked over to Romanda's platform, but Romanda raised a hand slightly as soon as she opened her mouth. "What is there to discuss, until we know what the proposal is, Salita?" The Tyran sitter's round face was as unreadable as a stone, but after a moment she nodded and resumed her seat. She was not unintelligent, far from it, just unsuitable. At last Moria returned, leading a tall woman in dark green, her dark hair pulled back severely from a stern, ivory face and held by a silver comb, and everyone climbed back to their benches. Three men with swords at their hips trailed after her through the watching sisters and into the pavilion. Unusual, that. Very unusual when matters had been sealed to the hall. Romanda paid them little mind at first, though. She had had no real interest in warders since her last had died a good many years earlier. But someone among the greens gasped, and Eledrin squeaked. She actually squeaked. And she was staring at the warders. That had to be what they were, and not only because they were healing the green. There was no mistaking a warder's deadly grace. Romanda took a longer look and nearly gasped herself. They were disparate men, alike only in the way a leopard was like a lion. But one, a pretty sundark boy with his hair in belled braids, garbed all in black, wore a pair of pins on the tall collar of his coat. A silver sword, and a sinuous-maned creature in red and gold. She had heard enough descriptions to know she was looking at an Ashaman. An Ashaman who had been bonded, apparently. Gathering her skirts, Melinde jumped down and rushed out into the crowd of sisters. Surely she was not frightened. Although Romanda admitted to a hint of unease herself, if only to herself. "You are not one of us," Janya said, speaking up where she should not, as always. She leaned forward, squinting at the new-come sister. "Should I take it you have not come here to join us?" The green's mouth twisted in obvious distaste. "You take it correctly," she said in a strong Tarabonner accent. "My name is Maurice Heimdall, and me I will stand with no sister who wishes to contend against other sisters while the world hangs in the balance. Our enemy, it is the Shadow, not women who wear the shawl as we do." Mutters rose in the pavilion, some angry, some, Romanda thought, shamed. "If you disapprove of what we do," Janya went on, as if she had a right to speak before Romanda. "Why do you bring us any sort of proposal?" "Because the dragon reborn, he asked Cadswain, and Cadswain she asked me," Maurice replied. The dragon reborn? The tension in the hall was suddenly palpable, but the woman continued as if she were senseless to it. "Properly, it is not my proposal. Jahar, speak to them." The sundark youth stepped forward, and as he passed her, Maurice reached up to pat him on the shoulder encouragingly. Romanda's respect for her rose. To bond an Ashaman was accomplishment enough. To pat one as you might a hunting hound took a level of courage and self-confidence she herself was unsure she possessed. The boy strode to the center of the pavilion, staring at the bench where the Ammerlin's stole lay, then turned about slowly, running his gaze over the sitters with an air of challenge. It came to Romanda that he was unafraid, too. An Aes Sedai held his bond, he was alone and surrounded by sisters, yet if there was a scrap of fear in him, He had it under complete control.
"Where is Egwene Alvear?" he demanded. "I was ordered to lay the offer before her."
"Manners, Jar," Maurice murmured, and his face colored.
"The mother is unavailable at the moment," Ramonda said smoothly. "You can tell us, and we will tell her as soon as we can. This offer comes from the Dragon Reborn?"
"And Cadswain. But learning what that woman was doing in company with the Dragon Reborn was secondary." Instead of answering, he snarled and spun to face Maurice.
"A man just tried to listen in," he said. "Or maybe it was that Forsaken who killed Eben."
"He is right," Aledrin's voice was unsteady. "At least something touched my warding, and it wasn't Sidar."
"He's channeling?" someone said incredulously.
A flurry broke out of sitters shifting on the benches, and the light of the power enveloped several. Abruptly, Delana stood.
"I need a breath of fresh air," she said, glowering at Jahar as though she wanted to rip his throat out.
"There's no need to be uneasy," Ramonda said, though she was not sure herself, but Delana, wrapped in her shawl, hurried from the pavilion. Melind passed her coming in, as did Nacella, a tall, slender Malkieri, one of the handful remaining in the tower. A good many had died in the years after Malkier fell to the Shadow, letting themselves be pulled into schemes to avenge their native land, and replacements had been few and far between since. Nacella was not particularly intelligent, but then Greens did not need intelligence, only courage.
"This session has been sealed to the hall, Melind," Ramonda said sharply.
"Nacella needs only moments," Melind replied, rubbing her hands together. Irritatingly, she did not even bother to look at Ramonda, keeping her eyes on the other Green.
"This is her first chance to test a new weave. Go ahead, Nacella, try it."
The glow of Sidar appeared around the slim Green.
Shocking! The woman neither asked permission nor told them what weave she intended, although tight strictures held on what uses of the power were allowed in the hall. Channeling all of the five powers, she wove around the Ashaman something that seemed akin to the weave for detecting residues, a thing Ramonda had small facility for. Nacella's blue eyes widened.
"He is channeling," she breathed. "Or at least, holding Sidine."
Ramonda's eyebrows climbed. Even Lilaine gasped. Finding a man who could channel was always a matter of reading the residues of what he had done, then arduously narrowing the suspects down to the true culprit. Or rather, it had been. This was truly wondrous. Or would have been, before men who could channel started wearing black coats and strutting around openly. Still, it negated one advantage those men had always had over Aes Sedai. The Ashaman seemed not to care. His lip curled in what might have been a sneer.
"Can you tell what he is channeling?" she asked, and disappointingly Nacella shook her head.
"I thought I'd be able to, but no. On the other hand..."
"You there, Ashaman! Extend a flow toward one of the sitters. Nothing dangerous, mind, and do not touch her."
Maurice glowered at her, fists planted on her hips. Maybe Nacella failed to realize he was one of her warders. She certainly gestured at him in peremptory fashion. A stubborn cast to his eyes, Jahar opened his mouth.
"Do it, Jahar," Maurice said. "He is mine, Nacella, but I will let you give him an order, this once."
Nacella looked shocked. Apparently she had failed to realize.
For the Ashaman's part, that stubborn look remained, yet he must have obeyed because Nacella clapped her hands delightedly and laughed.
"Saroya," she said excitedly. "You extended a flow towards Saroya. The Damani White, am I right?"
Saroya's coppery skin paled, and gathering her white-fringed shawl around her, she hastily slid back on her bench as far as she could. For that matter, Aledrin edged away on her own bench.
"Tell her," Maurice said. "Jahar, he can be stubborn, but he is the good boy for all that."
"The Damani White," Jahar agreed reluctantly. Saroya swayed as if she were going to fall over, and he glanced at her contemptuously.
"It was only spirit, and it's gone now."
Saroya's face darkened, but whether from anger or embarrassment, there was no telling.
A remarkable discovery, Lelaine said. And I'm sure that Maurice will allow you to test further, Nacella, but the hall has business to conclude. I'm certain you agree, Romanda.
Romanda barely managed to stop herself from glaring. Lelaine overstepped herself too often.
If your demonstration is at an end, she said, you may withdraw, Nacella.
The Malchieri Green was reluctant to go, perhaps because she could tell from Maurice's expression that there would be no further testing. Really, you would think a Green of all people would be careful with any man who might be another sister's warder. Yet she had no choice, of course.
What proposal does the Dragon Reborn have for us, boy? Romanda asked, once Nacella was on the other side of the warding.
This, he said, facing her proudly. Any sister who is faithful to Egwene Alvear may bond an Ashaman to a total of 47. You cannot ask for the Dragon Reborn, nor any man who wears the dragon, but any soldier or dedicated you ask cannot refuse.
Romanda felt as if all the breath had been squeezed from her lungs.
You will agree this meets our needs, Lelaine said calmly.
The woman must have known the gist of it from the start. Burn her.
I do, Romanda replied. With 47 men who could channel, surely they could expand their circles as far as they would go. Perhaps even a circle that included all of them. If there were limits, they would need to be worked out.
Faisella popped to her feet as if this were a formal sitting.
This must be debated. I call for a formal session. I see no need for that, Romanda told her without rising. This is much better than what we previously agreed on.
There was no point in saying too much in front of the boy, or Maurice. What was her connection to the Dragon Reborn? Could she be one of the sisters said to have sworn oaths to him?
Soroya was on her feet before the last word left Romanda's mouth.
There is still the question of covenants, to be sure we are in control. We still have not agreed on those.
I should think the water bond will make any other covenants moot, Lirella said dryly.
Faisella rose hurriedly,
and she and Soroya spoke atop one another.
The taint...
They stopped, staring at each other suspiciously.
Sidene is clean, Jahar said, though no one had addressed him.
Maurice really should teach the boy how to behave, if she was going to bring him before the hall.
Clean?
Soroya said derisively.
It has been tainted for more than 3,000 years, Faisella put in sharply. How can it be clean?
Order, Romanda snapped, trying to regain control.
Order!
She stared at Soroya and Faisella until they resumed their seats, then turned her attention to Maurice.
Can I assume that you have linked with him?
The Green simply nodded once. She really did not like her present company and did not want to say a word more than necessary.
Can you say that Sidene is free of the taint?
The woman did not hesitate.
I can. I took time to be convinced. The male half of the power, it is more alien than you can imagine. Not the inexorable yet gentle power of Sidar, but rather a raging sea of fire and ice, whipped by a tempest. Yet I am convinced it is clean.
Romanda let out a long breath, a marvel to balance some of the horrors.
We are not formal, but I call the question. Who stands to accept this offer?
She was on her feet as soon as she finished, but no faster than Lelaine, and Janya beat both of them. In moments, everyone was on her feet save Soroya and Faisella. Outside the warding, heads turned as sisters doubtless began discussing what might have just been voted on.
The lesser consensus standing, the offer to bond 47 Ashaman, is accepted.
Soroya's shoulders slumped, and Faisella exhaled heavily. She called for the greater consensus in the name of unity, but it did not surprise her when the pair remained firmly on their benches. After all, they had fought approaching the Ashaman at every turn, struggled, despite law and custom, to impede it even after it had been decided on. In any event, it was done, and without need of even a temporary alliance. Bonding would last a lifetime, of course, yet it was better than any sort of alliance. That implied too much equality.
A peculiar number, 47, Janya mused. May I question your warder, Maurice? Thank you. How did the Dragon Reborn come to that number, Jahar?
A very good question, Ramonda thought. In the shock of achieving what they needed without any requirement for partnership, it had eluded her. Jahar drew himself up as if he had anticipated this, and dreaded answering. His face remained hard and cold, though.
51 sisters have been bonded by Ashaman already, and 4 of us are bonded to Aes Sedai. 47 makes the difference. There were 5 of us, but 1 died defending his Aes Sedai. Remember his name. Eben Hopwell. Remember him.
There was a stunned silence from the benches. Ramonda felt a lump of ice in her middle.
51 sisters? Bonded by Ashaman?
It was an abomination.
Manners, Jahar, Maurice snapped. Do not make me tell you again.
Shockingly, he rounded on her.
They need to know, Maurice. They need to know.
Turning back, he ran his gaze along the benches. His eyes seemed hot. He had been dreading nothing. He had been angry and still was.
Eben was linked with his Daigyan and Beldane, with Daigyan controlling the link. So when they found themselves facing one of the Forsaken, all he could do was shout, "She's channeling Sidene and attack her with his sword." And despite what she did to him, ruined as he was, he managed to hang on to life. Hang on to Sidene long enough for Daigyan to drive her off. So you remember his name, Eben Hopwell. He fought for his Aes Sedai long after he should have been dead.
When he fell silent, no one spoke until Esmeralda finally said, very quietly,
"We will remember him, Jahar. But how did 51 sisters come to be bonded to Ashaman?"
She leaned forward as if his answer would be pitched as low. The boy shrugged, still angry. It was of no matter to him, Ashaman bonding Aes Sedai.
Elida sent them to destroy us. The Dragon Reborn has a standing order that no Aes Sedai can be harmed unless she tries to harm one of us first. So Taim decided to capture and bond them before they had the chance.
So, they were Elida's supporters. Should that make a difference? Somehow it did, a little.
But any sisters held by Ashaman brought it all back to a matter of equality, and that was intolerable.
"I have another question for him, Maurice," Moria said, and waited until the green nodded. "Twice now you did speak as if a woman did channel Sidene. Why? That do be impossible."
Murmurs of agreement rippled around the pavilion.
"It might be impossible," the boy replied coolly, "but she did it. Daigyan told us what Eben said, and she couldn't detect anything at all, even while the woman was channeling. It had to be Sidene."
Suddenly that small chime sounded again in the back of Ramonda's head, and she knew where she had heard the name Cabriana MacCandus. "We must order the arrest of Delana and Halima immediately," she said. She had to explain, of course. Not even the Amarlin seat could order the arrest of a sitter without explanation. The murders with Sidene of 2 sisters who had been close friends of Cabriana, a woman Halima had claimed friendship with as well. A female Forsaken who channeled the male half of the power. They were hardly convinced, especially Lelaine, not until a thorough search of the camp turned up no trace of either woman. They had been seen walking toward one of the traveling grounds, with Delana and her serving woman both carrying large bundles and scurrying along behind Halima, but they were gone.
Chapter 24. Honey in the Tea. Egwene knew from the start that her strange captivity would be difficult, yet she believed that embracing pain as the Aiel did would be the easiest part. After all, she had been beaten severely when she paid her toll to the Wise Ones for lying, strapped by one after another in turn, so she had experience. But embracing pain did not mean just giving way to it rather than fighting. You had to draw the pain inside of you and welcome it as a part of you. Avienda said you must be able to smile and laugh with joy or sing while the worst of the pain still gripped you. That was not so easy at all. That first morning before dawn in Sylviana's study, she did her best, while the mistress of novices plied a hard-soled slipper on her bared bottom. She made no effort to stifle her sobs when they came, or later her wordless howls. When her legs wanted to kick, she allowed them to flail until the mistress of novices trapped them under one of hers, awkwardly because of Silviana's skirts, and then she let her toes drum the floor while her head tossed wildly. She tried to draw the pain inside her, to drink it in like breath. Pain was as much a part of life as breathing. That was how the Aiel saw life. But, oh, light, it hurt! When she was finally allowed to straighten after what seemed a very long time, she flinched when her shift and dress fell against her flesh. The white wool seemed heavy as lead. She attempted to welcome the scalding heat. It was hard, though, so very hard. Still, it seemed that her sobbing stopped very quickly of its own accord, and her flow of tears dried up rapidly. She did not snivel or writhe. She studied herself in the mirror on the wall with its fading gilt. How many thousands of women had peered into that mirror over the years? Those who were disciplined in this room were always required to study their own reflection afterward and think over why they had been punished. But that was not why she did it. Her face was still red, yet already it looked calm. Despite the painful heat in her bottom, she actually felt calm. Perhaps she should try singing? Perhaps not. Plucking a white linen handkerchief from her sleeve, she carefully dried her cheeks. Silviana studied her with a look of satisfaction before replacing the slipper in the narrow cabinet opposite the mirror. "I think I got your attention from the start, or I'd have gone harder," she said dryly, patting the bun on the back of her head. "I doubt I will see you again soon, in any case. You may like to know that I asked questions as you requested." Melaire had already begun asking. "The woman is Liana Sharif, though the light knows how." Trailing off, shaking her head, she pulled her chair back around behind the writing table and sat. "She was most anxious about you, more so than about herself. You may visit her in your free time, if you have any free time. I'll give instructions. She's in the open cells. And now you had better run if you want anything to eat before your first class." "Thank you," Egwene said, and turned toward the door. Silviana sighed heavily. "No curtsy, child?" Dipping her pen in the silver-mounted ink jar, she began to write in the punishment ledger, a neat, precise hand. "I will see you at midday. It seems you will eat both of your first two meals back in the tower standing." Egwene could have left it there. But in the night, while waiting for the sitters to gather in the hall in Telairun Riod, she had decided on the fine line she must walk. She meant to fight, yet she had to do it while appearing to go along, to some extent at least, within the limits she set herself. Refusing every order would mean appearing merely obstinate, and perhaps would get her confined to a cell where she would be useless. But some commands she must not obey if she was to maintain any scrap of dignity, and that she had to do, more than scraps. She could not allow them to deny who she was, however hard they insisted. "The Ammerlin seat curtsies to no one," she said calmly, knowing full well the reaction she would get. Silviana's face hardened, and she took up her pen again. "I will see you at the dinner hour as well. I suggest you leave without speaking further, unless you wish to end spending the entire day over my knee." Egwene left without speaking, and without curtsying. A fine line, like a wire suspended over a deep pit, but she had to walk it. To her surprise, Alviarin was pacing up and down in the hall outside, wrapped in her white-fringed shawl and hugging herself, staring at something in the unseen distance. She knew the woman was no longer Elida's keeper, if not why she had been removed so suddenly. Spying in Telairun Riod gave only glimpses and snatches. It was an uncertain reflection of the waking world in so many ways. Alviarin must have heard her yowling, but strangely, Egwene felt no shame. She was fighting an odd battle, and in battle you took wounds. The normally icy white did not appear so cool today. In fact, she seemed quite agitated,
her lips parted and her eyes hot. Egwene offered her no courtesies, yet Alviarin only gave her a baleful glare before entering Sylviana's study. A fine line. A little down the corridor, a pair of reds stood watching, one round-faced, the other slender, both cool-eyed, with shawls draped along their arms so the long red fringe was displayed prominently. Not the same pair who had been there when she woke, but they were not present by happenstance. They were not precisely guards, and then again they were not precisely not guards, either. She did not curtsy to these, either. They watched her without expression. Before she had taken more than half a dozen steps along the red and green floor tiles, she heard a woman's pained howling start up behind her, hardly muffled at all by the heavy door to Sylviana's study. So Alviarin was taking a penance, and not doing well to be shrieking at the top of her lungs so soon, unless she also was trying to embrace pain, which seemed unlikely. Egwene wished she knew why Alviarin was undergoing penance, if it was an imposed penance. A general had scouts and eyes and ears to inform him on his enemy. She had only her own eyes and her own ears and what little she could learn in the unseen world. Any scrap of knowledge might prove useful, though, so she must dig for every one possible. Breakfast or no breakfast, she returned to her tiny room in the novice quarters long enough to wash her face in cool water at the washstand and comb her hair. That comb, which had been in her belt pouch, was among the few personal belongings she retained. In the night, the clothes she had been wearing when captured vanished, replaced by novice white, but the dresses and shifts that hung from pegs on the white wall truly were hers. Stored away when she was raised, accepted, they still carried small tags stitched with her name sewn into their hems. The tower was never wasteful. You never knew when a new girl would fit an old set of clothes. But having nothing to wear save novice white did not make her a novice, whatever Elida and the others believed. Not until she was sure that her face was no longer red and she looked as collected as she felt did she leave. When you had few weapons, your appearance could be won. The same two reds were waiting on the railed gallery to shadow her. The dining hall, where novices ate, lay on the lowest level of the tower to one side of the main kitchen. It was a large, white-walled chamber, plain, though the floor tiles showed all the Ajar colors, and filled with tables, each of which could accommodate 6 or 8 women on small benches. 100 or more white-clad women were sitting at those tables, chattering away over breakfast. Elida must be very set up over their number. The tower had not held so many novices in years. Doubtless even news of the tower breaking had been enough to put the thought of going to Tar Valon into some heads. Egwene was not impressed. These women filled barely half the dining hall, if that, and there was another like it one floor up, closed now for centuries. Once she gained the tower, that second kitchen would be opened again, and the novices still would need to eat by shifts. Something unknown since well before the Trolloc Wars. Nicola caught sight of her as soon as she walked in. The woman appeared to have been watching for her, and nudged the novices to either side. Silence slid across the tables in a wave, and every head turned as Egwene glided down the central aisle. She looked neither to left nor right. Halfway to the kitchen door, a short, slim novice with long, dark hair suddenly stuck out a foot and tripped her. Catching her balance just short of falling on her face, she turned coolly. Another skirmish. The young woman had the pale look of a Kyrianan. This close, Egwene could be sure that she would be tested for accepted unless she had other failings, but the tower was good at rooting out such things. "What is your name?" she said.
"Alvistair," the young woman replied, her accent confirming her face.
"Why do you want to know? So you can carry tales to Sylviana? It will do you no good. Everyone will say they saw nothing."
"A pity that, Alvis dear. You want to become Aes Sedai and give up the ability to lie, yet you want others to lie for you. Do you see any inconsistency in that?"
Alvis dear's face reddened.
"Who are you to lecture me?"
"I am the Ammerlin Seat. A prisoner, but still the Ammerlin Seat." Alvastir's big eyes widened, and whispers buzzed through the room as Egwene walked on to the kitchen.
They had not believed she would still claim the title while garbed in white and sleeping among them. As well to disabuse them of that notion so quickly. The kitchen was a large, high-ceilinged room with gray-tiled floors, where the roasting spits in the long stone fireplace were still, but the iron stoves and ovens radiated enough heat that she would have begun perspiring immediately had she not known how to ignore it. She had labored in this kitchen often enough, and it seemed certain she would again. Dining halls surrounded it on three sides, for the accepted and for Aes Sedai as well as novices. Laris, the mistress of the kitchens, was waddling about, sweaty-faced, in a spotless white apron that could have made three novice dresses, waving her long wooden spoon like a scepter, as she directed cooks and undercooks and scullions, who scurried for her as fast as they would have for any queen. Perhaps faster. A queen would be unlikely to give anyone a smack with her scepter for moving too slowly. A great deal of the food seemed to be going on to trays, sometimes worked silver, sometimes carved wood, and perhaps gilded, that women carried away through the door to the sisters' main dining hall. Not kitchen-serving women with the white flame of Tarvalin on their bosoms, but dignified women in well-cut woolens with an occasional touch of embroidery, sisters' personal servants, who would make the long climb back to the Aja quarters. Any Aes Sedai could eat in her own rooms if she wished, though it meant channeling to warm the food again, yet most enjoyed company at meals. At least they had. That steady stream of women carrying out cloth-covered trays was a confirmation that the White Tower was spider-webbed with cracks. She should have felt pleasure at that. Elida stood on a platform that was ready to crumble beneath her. But the tower was home. All she felt was sadness, and anger at Elida, too. That one deserved to be pulled down simply for what she had done to the tower since gaining the stolen staff. Laris gave her one long look, drawing in her chin until she had a fourth, then returned to brandishing her spoon and looking over an undercook's shoulder. The woman had helped Swan and Lyanna escape once, so her loyalties to Elida were weak. Would she help another now? She was certainly making every effort to avoid looking in Egwene's direction again. Another undercook who likely did not know her from any other novice. A smiling woman still working on her second chin handed her a wooden tray with a large, stout cup of steaming tea and a thick, white-glazed plate of bread, olives, and crumbly white cheese that she carried back into the dining hall. Silence fell again, and once more every eye centered on her. Of course. They knew she had been summoned to the Mistress of Novices. They were waiting to see whether she would eat standing. She wanted very much to ease herself onto the hard wooden bench, but she made herself sit down normally, which reignited the flames, of course, not as strongly as before, yet strong enough to make her shift before she could stop herself. Strangely, she felt no real desire to grimace or squirm. To stand, yes, but not the other. The pain was part of her. She accepted it without struggle. She tried to welcome it, yet that still seemed beyond her. She tore a piece of bread. There were weevils in the flour here, too, it appeared. And slowly the conversation in the room started up again, quietly because novices were expected not to make too much noise. At her table also the talk resumed, though no one made any effort to include her. That was just as well. She was not here to make friends among the novices, nor to have them see her as one of themselves. No, her purpose was far different. Leaving the hall with the novices after returning her tray to the kitchen, she found another pair of reds waiting for her. One was Katerina Alruddin, vulpine in copiously red-slashed grey, a mass of raven hair falling in waves to her waist, and her shawl looped over her elbows. "Drink this," Katerina said imperiously, extending a pewter cup in one slim hand. "All of it, mind." The other red, dark and square-faced, adjusted her shawl impatiently and grimaced. Apparently she disliked acting as a serving woman even by association, or perhaps it was dislike for what was in the cup. Suppressing a sigh, Egwene drank. The weak fork-root tea looked and tasted like water tinged a faint brown, with just a hint of mint. Almost a memory of mint, rather than the taste itself. Her first cup had been soon after waking, the Red Sisters on duty, eager to be done with shielding and about their own business. Katerina had let the hours slip a little, yet even without this cup, she doubted she would have been able to channel very strongly for some time yet. Certainly not with enough strength to be useful.
"I don't want to be late for my first class," she said, handing the cup back.
Katerina took it, though she seemed surprised to realize that she had. Egwene glided on after the novices before the sister could object, or remember to call her down for failing to curtsy.